Buchholz, and you are listening to Looking Up with Don. This is the Looking Up with Don podcast, episode number 16, for the week of April 22nd, 2020. The related website for this podcast is donmacholz.com. That is spelled donmacholz.com. What's up in the sky this week? As we begin our week on Wednesday, April 22nd, the moon is new, that it is more or less between the sun and us, and you can't see it. Over the next week, the moon will be showing in the evening sky, starting as a crescent low in the west, and each night higher in the sky and brighter. One aspect of astronomy that has become popular over the past few decades is, how soon after new moon can you see it in your evening sky? Some astronomers have made this their obsession, trying to do better and better each month. They have become experts at this, and it has sharpened their visual abilities. This month, the moon is new at 0225 Universal Time on April 23rd, and that translates to late in the evening in the continental U.S. on April 22nd. Now, you're not going to see the moon in your evening sky on April 22nd, but it might be visible with clear skies and a low horizon on Thursday, April 23rd, which is 24 hours after new moon. The moon will set only 40 minutes after sunset, so the sky will still be fairly bright in the west while you're looking for that thin lunar crescent. Hint, use binoculars or a wide-field telescope. After you find it with those instruments, see if you can see it with the unaided eye. If so, you have seen the moon 24 hours after new moon. Not a record, but pretty good. The record for seeing it with optical aid is 11 hours 40 minutes past new, and that was set in the year 2002. The youngest moon seen with the unaided eye is 15 hours 32 minutes in 1990. Now, those who are east and in Europe and Africa, if you see it, it will be less than 24 hours old. You can do this every month, and each month is different. Depending upon exactly when the moon is new, the first moon set from your location after new moon might be 24 hours after new moon, or 18 hours, or 10 hours, or whatever. The next night, it might be 48 hours, or 31 hours, or 29 hours, or whatever. This time of year, the northern hemisphere is favored for seeing the crescent moon in the evening sky due to the tilt of the ecliptic. The moon is moving almost straight up from the sun. This hobby, seeing the thin crescent moon, is known as seeing the youngest moon. It can also be done in the morning sky just before the moon becomes new. Then it is known as seeing the oldest moon. The planet Venus still dominates our evening sky. On April 25th, the moon will be below and south of Venus, and on the 26th, the moon will be above and south of Venus. This is another good photo opportunity. Will you be able to see the International Space Station this week? Well, it depends upon your location. For this week, those north of about 50 degrees north will not see it at all. That would include Canada, Finland, Greenland, and England. Those between 35 degrees and 50 degrees north will see it in their morning sky beginning April 24th, 25th, 26th. If you live between 35 degrees north and the equator, you can see it in your morning sky. Now, that would be Mexico City, India. Those are morning sightings. Between the equator and about 25 degrees south, no show, nothing. Meanwhile, Australia, South Africa, Argentina can see the International Space Station until April 23rd, 24th, 25th in the evening sky, and then nothing for the rest of the week. New Zealand will be able to see it all week long in the evening sky. To determine where it will be in your sky, you can go to the website heavens-above.com and enter your location, then click on ISS. Comets. Comets are really dominating the sky. You can use Podcast 15, Map Number 4, from last week, to locate three comets in our northern evening sky. Now, the tick marks for the comets for each day is for 0 hour universal time. So here are those three comets in our evening northern sky. Comet 2019 Y4 Atlas. This was the one that was expected to perhaps become very bright. It has begun to fragment, but don't give up on it yet. Yeah, it fragmented, but it's still hanging in there. And believe me, these are the most exciting comets to watch. Unpredictable, inexplicable, once busted up, now busting out. Gas and dust tail. Small-scale detail. Written off as dead. Apparently it was misread. See Comet Atlas, it's a splendid actress. What will it do next week? Take a sneak peek. Will it be bright or bleak? The second comet in the same part of the sky is the other Comet Atlas, 2019 Y1. It had a small outburst last week and is now easily magnitude 8. To complete our three-ring circus, we have Comet 2017 T2 Pan-STARRS, which is about magnitude 8. Having three comets in one section of the sky is rare indeed, so don't let this opportunity pass you by. The moon is creeping into our evening sky. For the early part of the week, you can wait until moonset to pick up these three comets. Headed into this year, we had not expected to see many bright comets, but the pleasant surprise is that recent discoveries have stepped up to the plate. But wait, there is more. Comet Swan. Last week I mentioned a new comet discovered on images taken by the SOHO satellite using the Swan images. These images are downloaded every couple of days, and they can be accessed by anyone, anywhere. This comet is in the southern morning sky, magnitude 8, and is slowly headed north. The official name is C/2020F8. Swan, spelled S-W-A-N. All four letters are capitalized. It has been observed for a week now and has held steady, but we know that comets are unpredictable. Podcast 16, Map 2. This is a map drawn for observing from the southern hemisphere. Shows the comet for the next couple weeks. In the northern hemisphere, our first view of this comet will be about May 7th in the early morning eastern sky, almost due east. By then, the comet will be moving northward at more than 4 degrees per day. On the morning of May 22nd, Comet Swan and Comet Atlas, remember the one that fragmented, Comet Atlas? They will be in the same vicinity, within 5 degrees of each other. Comet Swan by then will be headed east, and Comet Atlas headed south. Now, this could be a great photo opportunity next month. Two comets close together, morning, northern, pre-dawn sky. What could possibly go wrong? Perhaps the most well-known double star is in the Big Dipper. Well, guess what? The Big Dipper is not a real constellation. The Big Dipper is a star asterism that is part of the larger constellation called Ursa Major, meaning Big Bear. But it's often referred to as a Big Dipper, and we will refer to it as that here. A dipper is like a big spoon. It's like a spatula that has a bowl instead of a paddle. The Big Dipper consists of 7 bright stars, all of them roughly 80 to 100 light years from us. 4 stars are in what is known as the bowl of the Dipper, and 3 are in the handle. We're talking here about the middle one in the handle. It is identified on podcast 16, map number 1. The bright star is Mizar. Right next to it, about 12 arc minutes or 1/5 of a degree away, is the fainter star known as Alcor. This is a true double star. They take hundreds of thousands of years to go around each other. Sometimes this group is known as the horse and rider. Mizar is magnitude 2.2, and Alcor, the fainter one, is magnitude 4.0. This is a difference in brightness of about 5, so one is 5 times brighter than the other. At star parties, we make it a point to show this to people, and it is a real crowd pleaser. Alcor and Mizar looks good in any instrument, and we will begin with the unaided eye. This star system is known for being an eye test. That is, if you can see both stars, then you supposedly have good eyesight. Actually, it's not too difficult to pick them out, especially if you have a dark sky and a steady atmosphere. Through binoculars held steady, the double star is obvious. Note the color. Each one is blue-white. There is a 1/5 degree between the 2 stars. You could fit nearly half a moon between them. Now that you see the alignment and position of the 2 stars, look again at it with the unaided eye. Now let's look at Mizar and Alcor with a telescope. The positions are most likely reversed from what you saw with the unaided eye and with the binoculars, and telescopes do that. If you look closely at Mizar, the brighter star, you will see another fainter star next to it. This was the first double star discovered with a telescope. Mizar's companion is 14 arc seconds away, magnitude 3.95, and takes 5,000 years to orbit Mizar. Mizar is actually a 4-star system, and Alcor a very tight double star system, meaning this is a 6-star system. 2 more things. There is another star in the mix between Alcor and Mizar. It is known as Ludwig's star. Finally, take a long look at this field through your telescope. Does it look familiar? If you saw the 1998 movie Deep Impact, this is what you saw. It was in this field of view that the imaginary comet was discovered that, in the movie, hit the Earth. No actual comet has ever been discovered in this field of view. Last week, I discussed my comet hunting site in the Santa Cruz Mountains in California. The mountain is called Loma Prieta. 2 words, L-O-M-A, then P-R-I-E-T-A. One would think with 1,600 visits to the site over 15 years that there would be a lot of wild stories, but there really aren't that many. I wasn't looking for drama. I just wanted a safe place from where I could search for comets. However, this week and next week, I want to share what life was like on the mountain in the middle of the night. There were some odd moments. Let's begin with the weather. Wind was the biggest weather problem at Loma Prieta. Sometimes, as a gust of wind would come by, I could hear blowing dirt hitting my one-piece suit. On the morning I discovered my first comet in September of 1978, my clipboard blew away and I had to chase it down. I was using a wide-field instrument and sweeping it slowly across the sky, so I did not need a steady telescope in order to continue observing. Some observers do, and they cannot tolerate wind, but I was always holding my telescope tube as I was pushing it across the sky. Having said that, what was bothersome with the wind was when it was gusty. It would pull and tug at the scope and make the sweeping rate uneven. The best nights were when the fog was below me, blocking the light pollution from San Jose, Gilroy, Morgan Hill, and the Santa Cruz area. Fog would occasionally rise up to my level at 3,300 feet, and a few times, and this was both odd and neat at the same time, I would be sweeping and have my eye at the telescope for minutes at a time. I would then begin to notice I was seeing fewer and fewer stars, so I would wipe the eyepiece thinking it had fogged over, but I still saw a few stars. Finally, I would lift my head from the eyepiece, remove the eye patch, put on my glasses, and see I was in fog, dense fog, that fast. One morning, fog came in, and I waited my customary 40 minutes to see if it would clear, and if not, pack up and head home. It started snowing. That was odd. Another time, I was driving up to the site, a mile short of my observing site, and the car was losing traction due to ice and snow on the road surface. I got out and started to put on the chains, and the car began, all by itself, to slide towards me, and I had nowhere to go as behind me was a raised embankment. If the car had not stopped when it did, I might have been pinned by my own car. I believe the coldest temperature I ever had there was windy and 21 degrees Fahrenheit, which is minus 6 degrees Celsius. Now, that might not seem like much, but I sat still for 2.5 hours in those conditions. Refer to podcast episode 10 for a story about my electric socks. Occasionally, at the end of the session, when I removed my one-piece suit, I would find frost on the back of my suit. My warmest temperature when we had an inversion in the atmosphere was 83 degrees in the morning. That's 28 degrees Celsius. It was a 30-minute drive to my comet hunting site from Los Gatos. After I got married and we moved to San Jose, it was a 40-minute drive. I had a Ford Maverick, which carried the complete telescope, the 48-inch long optical tube for my 10-inch reflector, lay in a cradle in my back seat, as did half the pipe mount. In the trunk were the counterweights, half the mount, the telescope cradle, a star atlas, and clipboard. Front passenger seat was my chair and eyepieces, and I kept the eyepieces in a fishing tackle box. Everything had its place. In 1982, we got a Toyota pickup truck with a camper shell. That following year, I built my big binoculars, and those fit in the bed of the truck along with the pipe mount. The roads are nearly empty that time of night. Looking back, considering the percentage of intoxicated and tired drivers on the road in the early morning hours, I was lucky to have no traffic incidents. In the winter, I would comet hunt until around 6 a.m., then get into the commuter traffic on Highway 17 headed north into Silicon Valley. Those commute drivers know the road well, and they drive that route like a speedway. If you were not going 10 miles over the speed limit, they swallowed you up. From the time I parked my vehicle, set up the telescope, put on my warm clothes, and began comet hunting, it was 10 to 12 minutes. I became very good at setting up and taking down the telescope in the darkness that was lit only by my parking lights. I put down a ground cloth first. It was an old bed sheet that I kept in a pillowcase in my trunk. I used this to keep dust off me and my equipment because I was setting up on a dirt road. And also because of the white sheet, I could see critters should any invade my area. I found spiders and mice, a couple of lizards, but no snakes. I also played the radio, mainly KLOK radio station from San Jose, easy listening music. Initially, the all-night disc jockey was Rocket Rich. Later, a guy named Jay Stone took over. Sometimes before I left the house, I would phone in a request and they would play some of my favorite songs, like Doctor My Eyes by Jackson Browne, or You Were On My Mind by the Wee Five, or Red Rubber Ball by Circle. The disc jockey asked me my name, and when I told him, he had trouble pronouncing and remembering it, so I became known at the radio station as Don the Astronomer. Don the Astronomer is out stargazing tonight, so here is his request. It's not that I'm afraid of the dark, but I am afraid of being afraid. There were reasons I played the radio besides being entertained. It helped me to keep track of the passage of time, and it covered up those little noises you hear when out in the middle of nowhere. A bird rustling in the nearby bush would scare me, so I masked that sound with the radio. While comet hunting, I used only two of my five senses. And for my sense of sight, I was using only one eye, taking in information as I swept the sky and processing it, looking for the faint, fuzzy objects. That kept my mind very busy, but not so busy that I could not think of other things, sorting out the past day or planning the upcoming day, figuring out some problem, obsessing on something. My other sense was my sense of hearing as I listened to the radio and was on alert for unusual sounds. One of my fears was that someone would approach me and harm me. For some reason, I wasn't so concerned about those driving by. Most of them just kept going. But I had great fear of someone walking up to me. Out in the middle of nowhere, no houses within miles. Why would anyone be out there walking at night? With a somewhat gravel road, I would be able to hear them while they were still a few yards away. Noticing that, I would have to remove my eye patch, get my glasses out of my pocket, put them on, reach for my flashlight before the said person would be within reach. One night, I was sitting there comet hunting, and suddenly I heard a voice say, "Hello." Scared me, and when I responded, my throat was so tight I squeaked a weak, "Hi." Turned out it was a young guy walking to work. He said he drove off the road a mile back and was walking to the summit of Loma Prieta where he worked at the radio transmitter building. He said he was out partying beforehand and probably had too much to drink. He asked for a ride the rest of the way, so for the first and only time, I got to the summit of Loma Prieta behind the locked gate. Before I left, he asked me to turn off the headlights on his car. I said I would. So after my comet hunting session, as I drove home, I stopped where he had crashed. His car was 30 feet down the hill, upside down, and yes, the lights were on. Being true to my word, I climbed down to the car, leaned way in to reach the switch, and turned off the lights, knowing that at any time the car could continue sliding. About 1985, there was a fire on Loma Prieta, and it burned the south side of the mountain all the way to the site from where I observed. A few nights later, I went up there and, in the darkness, noticed little flames flaring up in the wind a few hundred yards from me towards the summit. No one else was around. I was the only person witnessing this. I believed I just had to let someone know about this. I cut the session short and stopped at the local fire station at the bottom of the hill. I was told not to worry. This always happens after a fire, and at night it looks worse. Okay, mission accomplished. I did tell someone. A couple of mornings later, I was back on the mountain, comet hunting, when a vehicle pulled up and a bright light was shown on me. Blinded and looking away from the light, I heard the car door open, then close. Then I was told to stand up, move away from the equipment, and hold my hands where he could see them. He said he was looking for an arsonist, and he was young and he sounded inexperienced. And by his shaking voice, I could tell that he truly believed he had found his arsonist. The intensity of the moment became very obvious to me. My telescope looks like a cannon, and who knows? Maybe I'm launching flaming projectiles into the brush. He was in uniform, so I had no doubt he was in official capacity. He asked what I was doing out here, asked to see my ID, and asked if he could look through my car, which I allowed because I had nothing to hide, and I didn't want to get shot. After a few moments, he was satisfied that I was not a threat. I had him look through the telescope to see for himself the validity of my story, and then he left. I believed at that time, and have always believed since then, that if I had made a sudden move, or if I did anything to pose a threat, I would have been shot. You have been listening to Looking Up with Don, podcast episode number 16 for April 22nd, 2020. Once again, the related website for this podcast is donmachholz.com. That is spelled DonMachholz. God willing and pod willing, I'll be back next week for another episode of Looking Up with Don. We will discuss what is going on in the sky, our weekly check on Comet Atlas, the new Comet Swan, and more stories from Loma Prieta. Thank you for listening. See the sky this week. I'll see you next week.